The following program recounts the experiences of veterans that served in active duty or combat. This 30-minute episode contains graphic and potentially triggering language, particularly between 19 and 23 minutes into the show. Please be advised if you have been diagnosed with PTSD. We hope you enjoy the show.
You are about to hear Voices from the Mighty Pen Project on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. David L. Robbins is a founder of the Mighty Pen Project. David L. Robbins is an actor, a lawyer, an author of best-selling books, a playwright, a teacher, and a columnist for Boomer Magazine. He is the founder of three Richmond-based nonprofit organizations, the Podium Foundation, James River Writers, and now the Mighty Pen Project. David Robbins is with us on the Virginia Voice. David, why did you found the Mighty Pen Project? Tell us about the genesis of the project.
Well, first of all, Lou, I want to thank the Virginia Voice for giving the Mighty Pen veterans this platform for these stories. Thank you for taking your time to MC it. And now I'll dive into that question. The power of writing is something that I think I know well. It's been my adult endeavor, learning how to do it, teaching others to do it as best I can. I have found and seen personally and experienced that writing can be marvelously cathartic, marvelously healing. But I honestly thought this was just a good idea. I didn't know this was something that would turn out to be as powerful as it is. I, as you said, I founded the James River Writers, and then with my friend Lindy Bumgarner, co-founded the Podium Foundation. And I've been teaching at VCU, and I taught at William & Mary for a while. So I've had a long association with writing professionally and helping others to get platforms to do it as well. And I read an article in the paper about a weekend writing program up in New York State for veterans. And I thought, a weekend? Come on, man. These cats deserve more than a weekend. So I went to the Virginia War Memorial and I said, what do you think about a semester-length writing program for veterans? And it suits everybody's purposes because the Virginia War Memorial, wonderful partner, they get stories that help catalog and memorialize service amongst Virginians. And I get to continue my sort of lifelong attachment to bringing writing to other people. So everybody won on that one. So we started the Mighty Pen Project in March of 2014. I had no idea how moved the veterans would be to be surrounding each other around the table and to talk about their work and then to turn it into writing. I honestly, every time I teach the veterans, which I do every Wednesday night, I am renewed in my belief in this program and my belief that the men and women who go off in uniform to fight our wars come back with some level, I guess we have to call it trauma. It's kind of a one-to-one correlation, some more, some less, but they bring something back. And I found, Lou, that the great majority of veterans who have deployed and served go, let's just say, undiagnosed and untreated. There is some level of trauma. And you find that veterans by inclination, constitution, and training just don't go ask for help. They're a tough bunch. Men and women alike, they're a tough bunch. The toughness is trained into them. And when they can go seek help and they can ask for that help, the VA provides it. You know, there's a lot of great therapy for veterans, but to a large extent, they don't ask. And, you know, look, God love them for that toughness, right? It gets them through things. What the Mighty Pen does is that I, as their teacher, and the other teachers we've put in that room with them, we ask them to go to the same place. We say, well, look, we need to visit those tough places. We need to go, like the stories you'll hear. We need to ask you to go to these tough places. But we don't do it for the purposes of therapy and healing. We do it for the purposes of good storytelling. But they still have to go to the same place, see? And so I've been told we have a VA psychologist in our class and on our board, Topher Murphy, PhD VA psychologist. And Topher has said to me that we in the Mighty Pen can get more out of a veteran in 12 classes than he gets in 12 years. Because they don't have to admit anything to me. They don't have to say I need help. They don't have to say I'm broken. They don't have to defy their own sense of their own powers. They just have to be good storytellers. And I didn't know this. I'm going to be dead honest. When I started this program, I thought this will be cool. This will be good. This will be community spirited. But this has become, and I hope the listeners to this program will see this along the journey with me. They will see that there's two really powerful components to these men and women telling their stories. One is testifying. their own stories, right? The other one is bearing witness. See, that's what I didn't know. I knew it'd be important to get it on the page and teach them the things I know about how to write. But when you have 12, 13, 15 men and women around a table from different branches and different different conflicts and different gender, different race, different ages, so much diversity, and they start talking about their experiences, well, they've got a dozen or so people around the table to hear them and give them that psychological visibility. And then in turn, 30 minutes later, it's their turn to bear witness to someone else. The bonds that form in that room, the support, the girders of affection and comradeship, I could not have guessed how important giving these people this platform is.
David Robbins, something that impresses me about you personally is you've written at least 12 books, most of which have been critically acclaimed, most of which have brought you probably a lot of money. But what impresses me is your research. You have gone personally to some of these far-flung countries to do research. You have Loberg. Did you go to Vietnam?
Oh, yeah.
And
I almost died there a couple times myself.
I mean, when you do research like that, you go to Israel, you go to Africa, you've gone to Germany. These people that you're talking to were there in person at the time that they're talking. How do you bring them out? How do you tell them to put their words that they know personally on paper so that it's readable?
Lou, that's a great question. My answer is, you ever, when we were kids, you ever snowball fights and you throw a snowball way up in the air and you get the guy looking at that one, then you level one right at him, right? You make him look somewhere else. It's like Ledger Domain, like a magician says, look over here, then he pulls the bird out of here. That's what we do in the Mighty Pen. It's not about therapy. It's not about catharsis. We never use those words. We don't talk about it in class. What we do is we say, I'm here as a college level professor, as a professional writer myself, and then the other people that we bring in to teach are the same, you know, qualifications or better. And we say, we're only here to teach you how to write. And we leave everything else to them. I don't say, hey, Lou, write about your time in Vietnam or your time in Fallujah. We don't do that. We say, write about whatever you want. You want to write a play? You want to write about your garden? I got a guy, a Sergeant Major, Marine Corps, 7 combat tours, dude, 7. And all he writes about is his garden and his arguments with his son-in-law over his garden. But he is one of the biggest fans of the Mighty Pen because he says, look, I can't do it. I can't write about my conflicts, but I know that veterans need to. So what we do is I don't say write your tough stuff. I say write. And they come to it at their own pace. We have a gentleman who one of his stories will be read here. And he lost his son in Afghanistan. He was a veteran himself. Good, good man, right? And he wrote 3 stories. And they were about his dog. And they were about being an MP at West Point. And then one day I said to him in the hall, I said, look, if you're ready to go there and you trust me now and you trust the men and women in that room, and I underscore something, men and women in that room, perhaps you'd like to write about your son. And he did. And it's one of the stories that you'll hear. And he wrote one of the most beautiful opening lines I'll ever hear. He says, everyone knows someone born to be a soldier. Mine was born to me. He's the only person in the 100 that we've taught that I've asked to write about their conflict. Everyone else comes to it naturally. And I only asked him when I felt it was time. We just teach them to write and they select. And given enough time and given enough trust. Look, some people like Steve Tedder, whose stories you'll hear, and David Aldrich, whose stories you'll hear, man, they rush right to it. They want to testify. They want to talk. They have a need to educate others about their experiences, and they have a need to understand them themselves. And by putting it on the page, they dismantle it, and they put it back together into language, and it helps them understand. Some people approach this at their own pace, and we in the Mighty Pen, we have no dictate at all, no pressure. We say, you got 3 hours of my time as a writing professor, let's use it. And if I may, if you ask what moves me most is at the end of every class, Lou, when I say, who's writing next week? Man, 5 or 6 hands go up. I don't have to go, you. I got to say, not you. They're like, me, I want this. Once they get the taste for exploring their heads and their hearts through language, they just run to it. It is the most gratifying thing to see the hands go up every week.
What are you about to read for us?
I'm about to read a piece by a man named Steve Tedder. Steve passed away about 2 years ago. He simply threw an embolism in the parking lot, fainted, fell, and landed on the tarmac, split his head, and passed away. And one of the things I want to observe on, if you don't mind, about Steve's passing is he did it in the midst of a bunch of veterans. Everybody was showing up for the class. It was a spring night. And I was horrified because I didn't serve and I'm not toughened like that. But these men and women, about five of them, Marines and Army Corps nurse, they were up to their elbows in Steve's blood. They just were fearless how they ran to his aid. And they just became young. And it was stunning to see how they became Marines again, you know. I'm going to read for you today a piece called Crispy Critters and Earning Your Stripes. It's a very hard piece. It's a very grim piece. Steve was one of those who did not stint. But if I may, I'd like to tell a story about Steve. So Steve passed away, and he was a gruff old bastard and beloved by everybody and had a very hard war. And when he passed away, his wife called and asked if I would read a story from Steve's writings of the Mighty Pen. And I said I would be honored. So I took one of his stories, and it was, as all of his stories, 12 and 13 page story. And I edited it down to like 7 or 8 so I could get it in. So I go to the funeral, and there's 400 people there. And Steve had been a pillar of his church, and he had these three beautiful daughters. And one of his daughters is in the military, and Steve told me that he had pinned his airborne wings on her personally when she graduated airborne, which is just tough, right? Beautiful. There were three logos in the program for Steve's passing. The Silver Spurs organization, because he was in the 9th Cavalry Silver Spurs, the Vietnam Veterans Organization, and the Mighty Pen. It meant so much to him, right? So the preacher talks for a while, and he asks me to come up. So I've got Steve's story with me. Now, Steve, and as you'll hear in Crispy Critters, there's some tough language. But, you know, when you edit, you want to edit to the writer's voice. It didn't take out too much. So I took out a lot of the F-bombs, but I left the sons of bitches and bastards and one or two F-bombs, right? Because I wanted to preserve Steve's voice. So I get up to the microphone, and I got to handle my own grief because, I mean, I love Steve and was with him. He took the class 4 times with me. Get myself under control, and I start reading. Well, the story is called Crashing an Officer's Party. Steve had been an enlisted man, a sergeant, and he was a gunner in a Loach, what's called a low-operating helicopter. His job was to fly with this crazy helicopter pilot behind a .50-caliber machine gun, just looking for enemies, you know, flying below tree level. Let me repeat, flying below tree level, right? That's how crazy this is. So he's flying along, so he sees a reunion for the 9th Cavalry Silver Spurs. He said, well, I'm going. Gets in his car, and he goes, and he gets there, and he finds out, drives all the way to, like, I don't know, St. Louis or something. He gets there, he finds out it's officers only. So he's like, oh, man. So just as he's about to turn and walk away, somebody recognizes him. Tedder, is that you? And he turns around, it's this guy that he knew, a pilot, and he says, yeah, come on in. So they all open their arms to Steve. You know, hey, come, you know, we're all comrades in arms, and he was a, you know, a tough guy, and they all knew him. So he's this great time at this party. So he's writing this, so I'm reading the story. And he says, and then this guy comes up to me, Gary Green. He says, now, Gary Green was the most famous wild man of all the pilots in the Silver Spurs. He had actually landed a helicopter, taken a POW himself. He says, he was the most metal-bedecked pilot of all the guys I knew. He says, except I hated the son of a bitch. And then Steve goes on in the story to talk about all the practical jokes this guy, Gary Green, had pulled on him. Well, one was called auto-rotating, where the pilot can detach the rotor from the fuselage of the helicopter. So in that moment, it's not the rotor that turns, it's the fuselage. It's a great way to turn 180 degrees in a fraction of a second, apparently. And Steve says, well, that's a great thing to do unless you don't tell your gunner, right? So he says, Gary Green auto-rotated on me once and scared the shit out of me. And I'm reading this, and he says, I pulled my service revolver, I put it to his head, and now there was like an entire paragraph of F-bombs and GDs, and I'll blow your, you know, you can imagine. Well, I didn't want to edit that because it showed the quality of Steve's temper. So I'm reading this to 400 people in the church. And people are laughing, and the story's going over so well. So I finished the story. And me and Rachel and Sergeant Major and Dan and Malik and Terry and a bunch of us, we're out in Midlothian for the funeral, and we go to a TGI Fridays. Now, I'm not much of a drinker, but, you know, Steve Tedder gets a day beer, right? So we're toasting Steve. Now, I am sadly a creature of occasional ego, and Steve meant a lot to me. So I said to this gathering of veterans who I love and know well, I said, so guys, I killed that, right? And they're like, what are you talking about? I said, well, come on. I mean, you saw the audience. I mean, you guys were laughing. Everybody was laughing at me. I said, Steve meant a lot to me. So it means a lot to me to have you tell me that I sent him off well with my part, that I did that well for Steve, because the crowd was just, 400 people were just howling, laughing. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I said, what? Were you not in the same room as me? So finally, Rachel, she says, David, no, it wasn't you. So what do you mean? She says, Well, the preacher was sitting behind you crossing himself every time you cursed. As if humility needs to be handed to you on the end of something like that. But with these kind of experiences, you can't buy, you can't anticipate. This program, the Mighty Pen Project, will continue to mean a great deal to me. I'm deeply involved in it. We're hoping to expand it. Me and the Virginia War Memorial, we are good partners. They're wonderful partners. And we're hoping to start expanding it to other states through other war memorials in other states. Because, look, veterans everywhere. And if you're a veteran and you hear this and you're listening to me, contact Virginia Voice or contact the Mighty Pen Project or contact the Virginia War Memorial. Let us know you'd like to take the program. And if you're remote and can't do it that way, think about getting things down on the page. I can't begin to tell you the experiences I've witnessed. It means a lot to the veterans, and therefore it means a lot to me.
You're hearing from author David L. Robbins, the person who started the Mighty Pen Project. David, what are you going to read?
I'm going to read a story by Steve Tedder called Crispy Critters and Earning Your Stripes. I want to tell the listeners before I read this, it is a raw and somewhat grim story about a helicopter crash that Steve Tedder went to. Before you settle in to listen to it, strap in a little or take a walk in the sunshine.
Here is David L. Robbins reading the story Crispy Critters and Earning Your Stripes by author Stephen Tedder.
The sky was eerie, a reddish glow from the sun. Sunset wasn't far off, and the contrast of the red sky outlining the green rubber trees throughout the base made me pause. I thought of an old saying, red sky in morning, sailors take warning. Red sky at night, sailors delight. Too damn bad I wasn't a sailor this night. It had been a long, tiring day. I walked down the red dirt road at Quan Loy that encircled the airstrip, heading to my hooch. We had departed in early morning for the area of operations and had made several insertions. We walked miles through the bush, most of it triple canopy. I was hot, sticky, and just worn out. My jungle fatigues were dust-coated and caked in dried sweat, my hair damp under my boonie hat. I smelled like a mildewed rag. I headed to the hooch, still wearing all my gear and carrying my rifle, centered on stripping off these clothes and getting to the shower before we ran out of warm water. Before reaching my sanctuary, the siren blared. Now what? The siren was only used in emergencies, usually for an incoming or ship down. Why the hell was a siren going off? There were no explosions, and all the aircraft had returned with us. People ran towards me, headed to the flight line. Leading the pack was Pilot Richard Fleener. Flea was soaking wet in combat boots, green underwear, and carrying his flight helmet. Apparently, he'd gone straight to the shower after our mission. He yelled that the ash and trash had called in a mayday and gone down. I followed Flea to the farthest revetment. A crew chief was untying the main rotor of his chopper. Flea climbed in the left seat. I took my place on the floor behind the right seat. We were the first on board. Flea hit the start switch and the big turbine engine. Flea hit the start switch, and the big turbine engine spun up. In no time, the flight line was filled with pilots, grunts, crew chiefs, and gunners, everyone running full tilt to their aircraft. It looked like a startled flock of birds. In reality, this was a choreographed dance. In no time, we had the co-pilot, crew chief, and door gunner strapped in. Six grunts from the aerial rifle platoon had also joined me to fill the slick. The grunts had little organization. They just picked a ship and clambered on. Normally, the pilot would run up the engine for 2 minutes before lifting off, but my crazy pilot, Flea, wanted to be the first in this big-ass scramble. Flea put the nose down. We picked up speed, climbing over the southeast perimeter into the most magnificent sunset of my life. The sky was still tinged red, and the sun sank fast. I was struck by how pale Fleener was. He really needed some sun. I started to laugh, but just shrugged. Another crazy sight in Nam. I can still see him there, sitting in the left seat in only his flight helmet, boots, and underwear. Before we cleared the town of An Lok, 4 miles south of Quan Loy, we saw it. At first I thought it was the biggest flare in the world, an intense, blinding white flame. I dangled my legs out of the aircraft holding my M16 and whispered the Lord's Prayer. We didn't circle to wait for the other slicks. The crew chief and door gunner cocked the charging handles on their M60 machine guns, pointed them at the jungle, and we went straight in. My three guys on the center seat scooted down to follow me off the skids. Together, we locked and loaded, ready to un-ass the aircraft. This was when your stomach tightened up. No grab-assing, no talking, just grit your teeth and concentrate straight ahead. The sun had sunk completely with just a hint of light remaining. The flames from the downed Huey were so bright, we had no problem seeing the ground. 5 feet up, Fleener flared the nose, slowing, our signal to jump. Soon as our feet hit ground, we set up a perimeter around the landing zone. I knelt behind a large bush. The downed Huey burned with a thick plume of whitish-gray smoke lifting into the freshly black sky. The flames made a low whoosh. The Huey was fully engulfed, sitting on its skids as if the pilot had landed it there. One of our two Cobras circled 200 feet above. His partner Cobra flew higher, ready to roll in with rockets if needed. For the next 12 hours, they would circle and protect us. I checked my men. The other Hueys made a beeline towards us. Normally, we only had 3 slicks with 7 men each on a combat assault, but they were bringing the whole platoon. We had no clue what caused the ash and trash to go down. It could have been ground fire or mechanical malfunction. To be safe, I assumed ground fire. Standing in the glimmer of the burning Huey, I held my rifle overhead to show the lead pilot where to drop off his men. Once everyone was off, the ships departed. I jogged to Sergeant First Class Happy Jack Jackson, standing with his radio telephone operator, Spec 4 David Reb Rutland. The burning Huey was no longer recognizable as anything made by man. The struts had given way. The main body and tail boom were completely consumed. I reported to Happy Jack that I had set up a partial perimeter. He asked if I'd search for survivors. I hadn't. I asked whose aircraft it was. It was ours, the ash and trash coming in from Dion. He strode off with the radio man to search for survivors. Without having to be told, the platoon formed a good defensive position around the crash site. In the last 13 months, the troop had secured dozens of downed helicopters. This was different, though, not a burning slick, never with so many men on board. Happy Jack and radio man Reb came back to where I lay in the prone position. Tedder, come with me. I need to show you some weird shit. He told Reb to stay. Reb stank of puke and seemed a little lost. I followed Happy Jack through the dark around the still-burning Huey. He told me where we were, somewhere south of An Luc near Highway 13, practically on top of one of the old French forts surrounding An Luc. He and Reb had found a lot of concertina wire and a concrete bunker just past the Huey. The pilot must have been trying to land inside the wide-open fort. As the flames of the Huey diminished, the smoke turned oily black, wafting across the ground instead of going straight up. Passing through the haze, we ran to get through as fast as possible. It carried the smell of burning flesh so thick it stuck to you. At the edge of the fort, Jack stopped. I could just make out the bunker that he described. He shined his flashlight down and said, "Look at this poor bastard." When he and Reb found him, Reb had upchucked. Jack needed help getting the guy out of there. The body was frozen in a crawling position, arms extended and one knee bent. He'd gotten tangled in the barbed wire and burned to death. His back and legs were fried horribly from the heat. I could tell that he was part of the 4-man crew. He still wore his flight helmet, also partially burned away, to expose his skull, hair, and melted skin. The two of us managed to push down the old rusty wire using our boots and pull the body out by its arms. Turning him over, we discovered that his face, chest, and stomach were untouched. He had compound fractures on both shins. We guessed that he must have been fairly high up when he jumped to avoid the fire. Happy Jack pointed his light at the name tag above the pocket on his shirt. Green. "You know him?" asked Happy Jack. "He was a crew chief, hell of a nice guy." We always spoke well of those we lost, but in this case I meant it. Vernon Green was an extremely nice guy, a lifer like myself. We wrapped him in my poncho and carried him to the front of the smoldering Huey. No one was near the area where the stinky smoke blew low over the ground. No big deal, our M60 covered a good field of fire on one side and the other was covered too. I came upon the number one screw-up of my unit, Spec 4 Schrader. He was out of position talking to one of the FNGs, the new guys. Schrader told him, "Yeah, we do this all the time. You think this is the first bunch of crispy critters we've pulled out?" That hit me like a load of bricks. I never heard that term before, crispy critters. I grabbed Schrader by the arm. "Come on, shithead, I need you over here." I tugged him to the area where the terrible smoke rolled. I yelled in his face, "You will stay right here, and you will not move. If you do, I will personally blow your fucking brains out." I returned to my position next to Donnie Bates. Donnie asked why I'd done that with Schrader. I said, "Because I could." Happy Jack came to ask the same thing. I described how Schrader had been out of line, trying to impress the new guy with being a badass. He agreed. PFC Schrader stayed in the smoke. Once we'd recovered green, we all just laid down there on the perimeter waiting for daylight. Once the fire burned out, the night became extremely dark. Clouds rolled in from the west to mask the moon and stars. By the last of the flames, we could see large black lumps inside the Huey, all that remained of our comrades. Half the guys in my squad had been in country well past their normal 12-month tour. They were draftees and had extended for a few months in order to get an early out, so soon as they could to return to the world. The other half were mostly FNG replacements. Even so, we'd responded like soldiers when that siren went off. As soon as the sun rose, a Huey landed in the center of our perimeter. Major Rafferty, the troop commanding officer, got out. Sergeant Middleton got a few guys to help unload the cargo. The major had brought cases of sea rations and body bags. No one touched the rations. Many of the guys had emptied their guts during the night. Sergeant Middleton came to me. Tedder, we're about to earn our stripes. Happy Jack wants the NCOs to get the bodies out. He doesn't want the men to do it. We can spare them that. We learned from the major that no one from the rifle platoon had been on the aircraft. The pilot was Warrant Officer Goltz. Warrant Officer Bennett was the co-pilot. I'd flown many insertions with them and knew both pretty well. The four of us, Jackson, Middleton, Doc the medic, and me, were given repelling gloves. Doc passed around a tube of mentholated cream to smear across our upper lips to hide the smell. It didn't do the job. The three guys that had been sitting in the cargo compartment had been crushed by the engine when the walls gave way. The four of us had to manhandle them out. The three were stuck together and we had to pry them apart. The door gunner was the easiest as he was lying in what had been the well behind his M60. Bennett and Goltz had to be pulled out of their armored seats. They still were in human form, unrecognizable, but you could tell they'd once lived as men. Goltz's right leg made a popping noise as we lifted him out. One minute, I was holding both legs, then the damn thing came off and I just had the leg. As soon as the last bag was zipped, we stacked them in Major Rafferty's Huey. The other Hueys landed to carry us back to Quan Loy. Upon reaching my hooch, I stripped off my uniform and gave it to Mama-san to burn. I stayed in the shower a long, long time. I washed the inside of my mouth and nose, but it would be a while before I could no longer smell it, even longer before it stopped bothering me, especially at night. 2012, Steve Goltz's hometown of Morton, Minnesota, had a Memorial Day celebration in his remembrance. The family asked for anyone who was a member of the Silver Spurs to attend. I almost found myself driving north to Minnesota, then I became afraid that someone would press me to tell how he died. I stayed home. It was never determined what caused the aircraft to catch on fire. All we knew was that Pilot Goltz only had time to shout Mayday. All the evidence was consumed in the fire. Personally, I could care less. It happened. You can't change it. I used to wonder why soldiers get PTSD. I was a police officer and saw some pretty awful things, but that was different. It came to me not long ago as to what made it different. Losing a fellow soldier becomes personal. You form bonds stronger than you'll ever experience. You live together, eat together, sleep together, even go to the bathroom and shower together. Your buddies know more about you than your parents or siblings do. Your family. When one dies or is wounded, you feel the loss. More, you realize it could have been you, not him. It's all based on fate. Many a better man than us meets his end. Years will go by and you will see big changes in your life, but the memories never fully fade.
You have just heard David L. Robbins reading Crispy Critters and Earning Your Stripes by author Steve Tedder. David L. Robbins, of course, is himself a best-selling author, in addition to having in his resume being an actor, a lawyer, an author of best-selling books, a playwright, a teacher, and a columnist for Boomer Magazine. He is the founder of three Richmond-based nonprofit organizations, the Podium Foundation, James River Writers, and now the Mighty Pen Project. What you have just heard David read is from one of the participants in the Mighty Pen Project. This is the first in a series of readings from the Mighty Pen Project that you will hear on the Virginia Voice. There are some 13 veterans who have taken part in the Mighty Pen Project, many of whose stories you will hear in the coming weeks. You are listening to Voices from the Mighty Pen Project on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.